Good morning. Greet each one in Jesus' name. Bear with me this morning. I had a little bit of a frog in my throat the last while, and I totally forgot to bring me anything along to help keep him in subjection, so I'll see how this goes, but hopefully it'll work. I thought just briefly, just got back yesterday, and yeah, I'd like to echo Jason's thanks on both fronts, the love offering and cleanup. Sure is nice when others show up to help wind up the Bible school up, the cleanup and all that. I thought I would say a few things. Possibly some of this will get talked about, so I thought maybe it'd be just best to give a brief report. I had a good term, I would say, from the teaching standpoint and financially. It was a bit of a rough term, possibly, from the administrative standpoint. And I don't know if I can really point launching into that. I would just say I'm really, really glad that we didn't have any 18-year-olds from our church there this year. It's just would have been not good. I think there's a lot of good still there, but seems like certain age groups have more difficulty maybe sorting through that. And it was a difficult term in some ways. And we'll be taking some drastic steps on some fronts. So anyways, I don't know that I'll launch into all that, but just thought I would share that and continue to pray for it. Probably as I get into the message, maybe part of it is a concern stemming from some of that things. I'm not saying this is the whole issue. But it's just something I've been thinking about and was actually teaching about somewhat as well, more to young people. And I thought, well, it's a broader scope than just young people, so I'd like to look at this for myself, first of all. And as I share on this subject today, I want you to realize I think I have as much need as anyone of this, because I really think a lot of it comes back to, well, you'll see here in a minute. I'd like to ask a question that I had in one of my classes on what has God, or what institution has God structured the rest of man, the rest of our relationships on? Can you tell me? On what institution does the rest of our relationships based on? The home, thank you. The home. What happens when the home is taken away or destroyed? Don't know? What do you think? I'm sorry?
Chaos.
Good. It's interesting that you use the exact same word that I got there, chaos, and I think it's a good word. When you take the home away, you have chaos. As I thought about that, you know, there's many politicians possibly today promising change, promising that they'll shake things up and correct issues. I'm not sure. I guess I'll let God and other people be a judge of that. They're either naive or lying, because you can't fix a president, I don't care, Congress, judges cannot fix problems that arise in the home, can they? And I think as you look at our nation and other nations, a lot of the problems, the trouble we're seeing, what we read about these days, have started in the home, haven't they? At a very simple base, and it's not going to be corrected from the top down. If there's a correction, there has to be a revival in how we view and how we relate to the home. And I would like to think that I'm talking to a group of people that has strong convictions on the home, and I believe that's right in a lot of ways. At the same time, just because possibly on the surface we look strong on the home, I would like to challenge myself, first of all, am I really strong on convictions of the home? And originally when I started preparing this message, I went pretty basic, and then I realized that I was going to have to preach another message that covered a lot of those points here in a while, so I thought, well, I'm going to delve into some mechanics this morning, so excuse me if I don't have as much scripture possibly or as much, baseband structure on this as what I possibly should have. It's because I split that off and went more with the rest. So how would you describe home? When we're talking about home the way we're using it, what are we talking about? Anyone?
One man, one woman.
Okay. One man, one woman, marriage, so that's sort of where I started. Any more thoughts? So you ever see a sign that says, home's for sale? Can you buy what we're talking about? And I think we know what it means, and I'm not here to be a word policeman. But, you know, they're not selling homes, are they? They're selling a house to put the home in, possibly. Merriam-Webster has sort of a long list. I don't know. Probably the one that gets the closest is the family social unit. And it's the people that make the home, not the house. And you know what's interesting? I think sometimes even in our circles we get that switched around a little bit, don't we? In that I'm not anti-house. Okay, don't get me wrong. I live in more than a tent, and I'm glad for that. At the same time, there's a family I know. I'll just use them as an illustration. The people, I don't know this family very well. I knew one person out of the family, and he passed away now. But I think they had 12 children in a house that was smaller than mine was before the addition, if I understood the numbers right. And but that's not, while I was told that, that's not really the first thing I was told about this family. I had a number of people tell me that this is a really outstanding family. So right there is some proof for that, right? That it's not the house that makes the home. So yes, we probably need a house to put our home into. Some sort of that, and I'll actually cover some points on that. At the same time, that's not what defines it. I just read, let's see here. Going to read Ephesians 6, verse 1 through 4, because I think there is scripture for most, if not all, what I say. I realize some of this is my application, so bear with me in that. At the same time, in looking at this, I'd like to look at the base. I should have started with marriage, like Johnny said, but there again, I thought maybe that'll wait for the future. I'm going to call this message, The Home, a Base of, and then I'm going to fill in what the home I feel is a base of, some primary parts. Ephesians 6, verse 1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. And then we have a repetition of the command from Exodus, or the Ten Commandments. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. Again, verse 3, a quote from the Old Testament, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. And then 4, maybe the verse I'll actually primarily focus on. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. May I put that into my words for today's language. And you parents, do not discourage your children, but as they grow, train them, correct them, and teach them about God and about life. And that's a huge responsibility, and I, in a way, I feel a little bad preaching maybe something so directed to the mechanics of the home. At the same time, I realize God has different places for different ones, but I'll just repeat something I've said. Sometimes I look back at my notes and I said, Joe, think to myself, Joe, did you actually say that? I think I grew a little bit. But there's one thing I haven't recanted one bit on, and that is I feel every individual needs to be part of a home. I'm not saying you can't live in your own house, maybe by yourself, but I do still feel like you need to be connected to a home unit some way, somehow, or you're going to miss out on something major that you need. That's my thought. If you want to discuss it more, get with me. So I think in this way, every last one of us had better be building home, regardless of where God has called you. And so, of course, I'm going to focus on the family unit within the walls of a house. But at the same time, I think every last one of us needs convictions on this subject, or we're in trouble in the long run. You know, the home, the base of so much. Think about this. This is the conclusion I've reached. For ultimate success and usefulness, the home must be the foundation of all religious, social, cultural, and economic orders. When this is misplaced, all suffers. And there's actually studies showing that whether it's the economy, whether it's national debt, whatever, if every married couple was to have a minimum of 4 children, the whole outlook would change pretty drastically. Think about it. Children power the future in a lot of ways, including economically. And when you start messing with that, you're messing with something that's pretty precious to God. And I won't say here this morning that how long a society can exist, I don't know, God knows that. But at the same time, you look at history, you look at society, and one reason I feel that the U.S. has had the economic prosperity and things it has had is because even though there's been a gradual more and more messing up of homes, if you will, at the same time, back in history, they got home about as right as any country in the past has. whether Christ-centered or not. At the same time is going on, we see that at least eroding in a lot of ways, and there will be a price paid. In fact, if you go back to Rome and Rome history, you know, we talk about the decadence that happened, the entertainment aspect, and those all played a role, but I still feel that the biggest role they played was actually in destroying the home, personally, as I've looked at those things. And again, I'll let it with you to do your own research. But for ultimate success and usefulness, the home must be the foundation of all religious, all social, all cultural, and all economic orders. And I was going to make some statements on marriage, but again, I think that'll wait for some other message. Here's something from the Mennonite Herald written during World War II. This was Conference Mennonite at that point, doing a study, and it says this. Basically, I condensed it. It was a long article, but it says those from urban, meaning city settings, Mennonite churches in a city setting, were more likely to join the military than those from a rural or country and farm setting. So they did studies. They had, if you will, the facts that this actually happens. So they went on to draw the conclusion that city life doesn't work for non-resistant people, basically. Like I said, I'm condensing it. What do you think? Do you agree with that? Be fun. This is a smaller class. I'd treat you like a class and go around and make you tell me what you thought. I guess I won't. So they had the data. They had facts for this, okay? Don't get me. This wasn't just somebody's idea. They did research into the churches, what composed the non-resistant churches at that point, and it was actually majorly holding out that way. So while I have to accept those facts, it seems to me that they drew a wrong conclusion. And the reason I say that is, where in the New Testament do you go to find that we are supposed to be live in a country, when I mean out in the country, and it's really best if you farm? Do you know where a verse is like that in the New Testament? I've still to find it. If you know where it is, please get me updated. In fact, most of the churches in the New Testament seem to have been somewhat more of a city setting. So I think I'm going to say this. I personally believe there's either a weakness in our culture, I'm talking as our church cultures, or a flaw in our convictions and application on the home. And you probably know by now which one I'm going to choose. I personally believe it is a weakness in our convictions on the home, and in our application of home structure and function. You know, whenever, even a church, I would say even on the church level, whenever we try to say we can fix things, we're just deceiving ourselves, because finally it's in the home that things change. So of course, if we have revival meetings and many of us, let's say that many of us as fathers repent of, say, just say lax parenting, wrong parenting on my part, whatever it would be, we can have a revival. But again, where does that revival really start? It starts in the home, right? So even though the church may have been a catalyst in some ways, it finally is not the thing that is changing it in the long run. Any change from the top down, rather than from the bottom up, if you will, in the home structure, will be superficial and fail. You know, here's an interesting thought. I thought I'd pull this out of the marriage. I've often heard it said that man, or possibly woman, is the last and crowning work of creation. You ever heard that? I think that statement's missing something. Because as I was reading through Genesis 1 there at the end, where God made man, 2 where he brought the wife together, and then 3 after the fall, you know what struck me? It's a little different than it ever did before, is that the last thing God created was what? The home. If you will, that was the last thing God created in the creation process, was the bringing together of man and woman to create home. So I think in that way, I want to look at the home as the final, the greatest aspect of creation. I was a little amused, and I don't mean this negatively at the writer at all. I was reading an autobiography, a book written by a person about themselves. But they started the book this way. It says, I was born, then they gave the place and the date, and that is when it all began. Is that accurate? I thought about, you know, I understand. In a physical way, in a way, that was correct. at the same time, it wasn't very, was it? So I stand here this morning trying to have my own home with my faults and failures in it, absolutely. I'm not quite sure. It's sort of interesting that my parents are with us this morning. So, you know, I was born later in the family, but really, in some ways, some of me began back when they began their home. And in fact, some of them began with their parents. And have you ever thought of how interrelated, if you will, interconnected our lives are to the lives that have gone before? Or for that matter, have you ever noticed how entwined our lives in the lives that go after? Right? Because I am now forming my children, and soon, not so long, they will be filling the roles that my wife and I are filling. So let me just read Psalm 127, verse 1 and 2 to you. I think this has to be the foundation of it all, really. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. Is my home a product of God's work, or is it a product of me and my thoughts? Except the Lord build the house, I labor in vain. Except the Lord keeps it, including my home, no matter how energetic, no matter how wise I think I am, I will just wake in vain. Then he says it's vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows. It sounds sort of like a parent that's struggling with their responsibility, doesn't it? So rise up early and sit up late and eat the bread of sorrows. That's sometimes how I feel when things aren't going so well. And I'm not saying that I don't take it serious. But remember, it's God that gives rest and peace finally. And I need to, if there's a need, take it to him. But then also make sure you allow him to have it. Here's another question we had in class. Why do many parents repeat the mistake their parents made? Would two or three brave people tell me why that happens? First of all, I asked my class, does it happen? And they agreed it does. So do you agree with that premise? Why do many people repeat the mistakes their parents made? Okay, because you focus on their mistakes. Thank you. Anything else? Trained that way. Okay, good. Appreciate that. I have three reasons. I just thought I'd break them down briefly here. His parents are a reference point, right? Sort of going with Ernie's thought here first. To make sort of a elementary comment, no one has been a parent till they are a parent, right? Do you have practiced parenting before you're a parent? Not really. It's not, you know, they have these programs now I read about where they have these dolls that cry and have to be fed and stuff trying to train parenting, but that's really pretty poor. I guess if you don't know how to do the physical things, which probably most of us don't struggle in the physical aspect of it as much as the rest of it. You know, finally, if you haven't been there, now all of a sudden you are, you're looking for a reference point, right? And we're programmed to look. When you find yourself in a situation you've never had to feel before, how do I do this? And so you go mentally without really a lot of thought. You go back and rehearse. Who else did I see do this and how did they do it? So how many of you have gone to parenting school? Parents here this morning. None. Come on. I have. Do you know what it was called, though? I don't know if they never gave me a degree, but it's called my childhood home. Right? If you went to parenting school, it's your childhood home. That's where you saw the lessons. That's where you saw whether this worked or not. And so there you go. And if you've been so there, you will use that as a reference point. You know, when facing a new or difficult position, we try to compare it to what we've seen and experienced before. Unless a cognitive thought process occurs and we choose differently, we will emulate or copy what we have observed in others. Second point in this is we have a natural tendency towards idolization or bitterness. You ever notice that? If somebody starts talking about their parents to you, it usually doesn't take long at all till you know they really appreciate them. Which isn't wrong. I'm not trying to say I appreciate my parents. But I'm talking, they probably almost over-appreciate some of the ways they did things. Or they're bitter about it. Most people fit in that category. I'm talking in a natural way. Hopefully you as Christians do not. But most, if you just let yourself go, you will either idolize, overvalue, or you will be bitter. Many is the parent who parents based on what they either like or did not like in their parent. Let me just say this. Neither idolization or bitterness lend themselves to serious objective thought. Do they now? Neither idolization or bitterness can lend themselves to serious objective thinking and goal setting. Appreciate the good. Forgive the less than the ideal. Seriously consider the task before you and give it your best, not your past, however you feel about it. Last point on this one is comfort zone. You know, when we've seen and experienced is what we're likely comfortable with. But unfortunately, times change and parenting requires adaptation and growth. Have you ever heard older children in a family say, well, we sure couldn't do what the younger ones can? I don't know if any family goes without that one to some extent. And I'm not, sometimes maybe it's good to be careful. At the same time, you know, it's pretty sad if I learn nothing from raising Kara till Kyla comes along, right? If everything, my first attempt was the best and now nothing changes. Well, appreciate your parents that weren't so stubborn that they weren't willing to change older ones. Some of us younger ones, I guess we should appreciate the ground that you older ones broke for us. The times needs to change. Parenting requires adaptation and growth just as any role does. You cannot set and forget rules and expect good results. And I love these brothers, but I think I'm going to tattle on them a little bit. You know, back when we were helping Summersville, or attempting to, church, we were traveling up and down quite regularly, and some of those late at nights there, Phil and Lauren were still here. One evening, Ernie and Phil and Lauren got to talking about how their parents gave them money or did not give them money in their youth, and it was interesting. I thought, ooh, well, here's a good thing. I'm going to learn how to do this perfectly between three of them. And they all grew up, I would say, rather differently from what I was gathering out of the conversation. And yet, they all thought the way they grew up was pretty much the way to go. So I wasn't sure which one. It was hard to combine them all. But and like I said, I'm just saying it more for the humor teacher in it than anything. But, you know, we get comfort, and so that works, so why mess with it? And there's some good in that. I'm not saying we try to tear up or blow up everything. At the same time, I think I, as a father, at least too much have the idea maybe I could just come up with a list of rules and now I can forget about it. It's not really that simple. You need to be adaptive. You know, another time I ran into this was actually some years ago. A young lady was struggling with home situation some, and she was majorly steaming about her dad and his cell phone rules. And she made the comment, and her dad said, well, when he was growing up, he didn't have his own phone, and he didn't know why she needed one. And he's like, well, they didn't even have cell phones back then. I mean, come on. That was her point of view. And about the biggest privacy he could expect on the phone, I guess, was a long cord. And yeah, I think so, because she had made the comment, they didn't even have cordless phones. And, you know, that's a good point. I'm not quite sure if I'm siding with her. But, you know, a parent that sets and forgets, especially in this day and age, what may work with your first children, technology changes so fast, you had better have some different rules in 10 years than what you had 10 years ago, right? The rules that that parent grew up with, I understand her frustration to some extent in that they were almost not applicable today. That said, I do think that the phone we have today versus the phone her dad grew up with actually is going to take a whole lot more work to keep a positive thing in his daughter's life, right? The other one was on the wall and you could only go so far till you pulled it off and you were done. The things we have today we can take with us and they do a lot more than just let us call people. So it will take adaptation, changing. Another thing I've often noticed is much too often parents expect their children to know, and I'm guilty of this very recently. You know, I expect my children to know. I expect when I say, hey, well, that wasn't real smart, or maybe you should tone that down, they know how much to turn the knob. And it sort of astonishes me when they don't. And I'm like, I thought we had this conversation. Well, but I didn't understand what you meant. Well, okay, I can tell you what I meant. This is what I meant now. Oh, well, but Dad, that's a little too much. Well, sorry, I was really wishing you would turn the knob, but if you can't, I will. You know, Joshua and Israel at and after Joshua's death, I ran across this verse here and it sort of struck me. Is children on their own, even under a positive influence, need something more? We need to give direction. We need to follow up on implementation and application. Notice this verse. So Joshua had passed on, and it says, Israel remained faithful as long as there was an elder or older people that knew Joshua. But once they were all dead, this is what it says. Judges 2 verse 10, and also the generation that were gathered, and also all that generation, Joshua's, were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them, which knew not, it didn't matter that they didn't know Joshua, but it did matter that they didn't know, it says they knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. You know, what happened? You had one of the most faithful generations that Israel had ever seen. Remember? All the people died in the wilderness. And you had this new generation that came in and cleaned house on Canaan for the most part. They made some slight mistakes, but compared to me, they made very few mistakes. And so throughout their lifetime, this was a great, great things happened for the most part. But it says, now when they all died, the next generation not only didn't know Joshua, but they didn't know God. How can you get there that fast? You know, friends, I don't know. I wasn't there. But I'm guessing that for as faithful as they were on the personal and the national front, there had to be have something lacking in their homes. I was trying to figure out what it could be based on what the Bible says. And of course, this involves some guessing on my part. But you know, children need love. They need attention. They need teaching. They need correction. And while a good example is a great start, it is not the sum of a child's needs. So just in looking at that passage and in trying to figure out what happened, my best conclusion is that these people were so busy cleaning house, if you will, for God in Canaan, that they maybe didn't take time to take care of things at home. I don't know. And you know, I've seen that happen many, many times today. Maybe especially preachers are bad for that, where they get so busy teaching, preaching, doing this and that, they fail to keep house at home. You know, it's interesting that one of the first requirements, or at least one of the main requirements that Paul tells Timothy for a leader is somebody that keeps house at home. So if I need help there, help me. You know, good parents don't only give direction. They don't only stand up here and preach about this, but they make sure that that direction is followed. When directions are disregarded, a good parent gives correction. We all know Proverbs 22:15. Some years I wish the Bible would have skipped that. It's such a short verse, and it's about the only place you actually find it said in plain language. Foolishness, or dumheid for Dutch, is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. Very true, huh? You ever notice that? Children are not naturally given to deep thought and wise counsels, are they? It takes some effort to get it in. And some reason, the backside assists. The home needs to be the base. So I have four things. Of love. The home needs to be the base of love. The home needs to be the base of protection. The home needs to be the base of obedience. And the home needs to be the base of self-discipline. Hopefully this won't take just real long. So the home is the base of love. It should be at home where a person first learns of love. So I split love into a couple different ways. Caring love. You know, the unselfish parents, changing diapers, feeding the baby, cleaning up after spills and throw-ups. That's caring love. And you know, I don't know, I guess it burdens me quite a bit when I hear parents with young children struggling with their role. I think Dad told me this one years ago about a man lived, I think, in Virginia. And somebody was sort of challenging him that he never went to the mission field. And he says, well, he wants to be willing to go if God wants him to go. At the same time, he has had the opportunity to teach the gospel to people that never heard it before. And they were like, what? Right here? And he says, yeah, to my children. And so I'm not discouraging mission field. Don't get me that way at all. But what I am saying is, parents, especially mothers, You have an amazing opportunity. If there's a faithful church tomorrow, it's because of faithful parents that are teaching young children the way of faithfulness in their early age. And if you're discontent there, trust me, your children are going to know it, and there's never going to be anything that can make up for that. If you struggle with the role God has asked you to fill, the best suggestion I can give you is just fall down on your knees and ask God for forgiveness and put your heart into it, because that is the way to faithfulness. I'm not saying there's not other ways, but for us, that is one of the primary ways to build church. Also, caring love. As the child gets older now, I'm thinking, of course, accountability. And you know, this needs to be from early to on. How did things go at school? Does your child's report of school line up with the school teacher's report of school? Is there just accountability? And of course, you also have to give accountability, maybe a bit more on that later. As the child gets older, I personally am one of the philosophy that I think we have to train our children to live in this dangerous world. I don't just say we'll ride a bike around the country because driving is dangerous. You know, you can get hit on the bike by somebody dangerous as well. So I think we have to train how to live with the things that we face today. But that said, I think it takes accountability, whether it's of the car, where you've been, when will you be back, to, again, let's go back to the phone. When was the last time you as a parent, if your child has a phone, when was the last time you read their messages, looked over the call log, checked out the browsing history if they have that access, and left them do the same for you? You know, and I think some of this starts young. I know a lot of you are maybe even in an earlier stage possibly than I am. But it sort of dawned on me that, you know, I'd like some fairly real rules in my house on some of these dangerous things. And I thought, you know, there's a temptation to wait till it's needed, right? It dawned on me one day here, I've got to do this right now. I don't want to be doing just however I want to do till my child is old enough that there's a problem, right? So I'll just tell you one thing I was going to bring up later. Right now, I've been reading some secular writing even. And this one secular writer said is we have to have tech-free zones in our home. So we've chosen not to have phones in our bedrooms anymore. And I started right now. Rather than waiting till I have teenagers that I'm going to require to do that, my wife and I quit. And you know, I think it goes beyond that. A young man just at Bible school this term was telling me how their mealtime is phone-free for them. And I think you need tech-free zones and times. If you don't, I think it will destroy us. That's if you want my opinion. It probably goes much further than any program we can install. Okay, sharing love. Do I always get and take the best? And I just had to think of how this can sort of subtly happen. And by example, and I feel a little ashamed of myself. But you know, I think I've corrected this one a good part, but it used to be we'd go to Andy's, I'd order the girls a little cup of ice cream, and I'd get me a turtle split. And I was thinking, that's not real good example training, is it, on a sacrificial. I'm not saying that you give your child everything you have, okay, I get it. But I had some twinges of conscience here in the past couple years where I think I'd gotten to a little bit of a rut I shouldn't have. Do I share the best? Is it with my wife, children? Do I get my wife a new phone, or does she always have my cast off? And you know, you could go a lot of ways, but just some things that another thing on sharing love, do I share when I'm wrong? Can I say I made a mistake? I'm sorry. Do I share my struggles? And of course, maybe being discreet, I'm not sure if some of you would like. Let's say I'm struggling with something in church. It's probably not wise to go tell my 8-year-old everything about that. But at the same time, do they say, hey, you could pray for Dad tonight? He's grumpy, got a bad attitude. Do I ask for help with my problems? And another thing that really struck me here is, are my children free to share their problems with me? Do I take them serious? Do I listen to them? You know, I'm not saying, especially as children get older, maybe especially with the age of children I was dealing with the last couple weeks, seems some form attitudes about their parents, and I'm not going to blame parents for all that. Please don't take me that way. And if my children are that age and they have a problem or a struggle they want to share with you, please listen to them and help them wisely. I'm not against that. That's not what I'm saying. At the same time, I've worked in enough situations where I said, well, you need to talk to your dad, your mom. Oh, no, I can't. Well, make sure that if they can't, it's their problem and not your problem, right? Parents. Because too often I think it is a parent problem. Self-centered, self-focused, disengaged parenting. Can they share? Okay, accepting love. I need to speak carefully on this one. I know I had a whole message on the couple messages on acceptance and rejection in the past. And I understand that different times and stages, I remember very well, sometimes when Dad would correct me there in my early teenage, maybe even, years, I would construe that as rejection. So I'm not saying that it can't be done where you're misread, but at the same time, I personally feel rejection and acceptance should not be used as control, child control tools, if you know what I mean. If they need punishment, punish them. Don't sort of keep them at arm's length for a while, give them a silent treatment or whatever it is. There's just no room for that in the Christian life. There's just much better ones. Does your spouse, do your children know, no matter how much they've messed up, no matter how many trees they ran over with your newest truck, you're there to help them figure out a solution? Whatever terrible thing you could come up with. Do they dare come talk with you, or are they like, I'm going to go hide under the bed till he finds out? Okay, last on love. No, I'm sorry, second to last. Corrective love. Corrective love. You know, I feel there's such a wrong view of love today, and I understand that we have the head knowledge, but I'm a little concerned that we are sort of succumbing in our heart that love is this unconditional, all-encompassing, whooshy thing that makes up for. And you know, that is not God's love at all. Correction is very much a part of true love. Proverbs 27, verse 5. Open rebuke is better than secret love. Proverbs 27, verse 6. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. A friend hurts, ouch. But, he says, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. And I think way too often, so to speak, in this love subject, we're thinking it's all kissing. And it's deceiving us. Not saying it harsh, unkind, or anything like that. Remember, I just got done telling you, be a place they can come even when they messed up horribly. At the same time, don't just smooth it over. If there's something that needs corrected, take care of it. Your child needs correction, or at least I should say mine do. It is selfishness, not love, to withhold correction when needed. Of course, temper correction with mercy, but mercy is not neglect. Clearly point out the need, the wrongdoing. Give correction that shows the seriousness of the issue. And I'm all for mercy. But you know, if I'm needing to address the same issue for the third time, continued mercy, at least in withholding fairly serious punishment, is no longer mercy. It's laziness. Okay, protecting love. Do I love enough to protect even when they don't understand or appreciate what I'm protecting them from? You know, it's not too hard to do in a I don't find it very much difficulty in telling my 2-year-old, don't ride your trike out. You mayn't ride that trike out in the road, right? You'd say you're crazy parent if you would. And rightly so. But you know, as they get older, as there's a 13-year-old that's making uneducated choices and needs some education, do I give it or do I maybe it'll turn out all right. Or about the 18-year-old who's formed a lot of negative friendships and is really on the wrong path. Do I protect? Do I set some boundaries? Do I say, you're not going there as long as I'm responsible for you? Here's another one. A little different angle protecting, but I think it is. Where does your son turn to when he needs help for victory? When he's facing a battle and he's not winning it, who does he turn to? Where does your daughter go when she's in a negative relationship? And you know, I almost find this hard to believe, and it's... I know of a young lady who was in a terrible relationship, and yet she was trying to hide this all from her parents, and when she was told she needs to share this with her parents, she's like, oh no, I can't. I'll get one of the youth boys in my church to help me. Seriously? It's not going to work. I don't know what's wrong in a home like that. Okay, the next category I have is the base of protection, and that's just the flipping of my last point on the love. Love protects, and I have the base of protection. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, talking about a widow, but it says, if any provide not for his own, in the context of taking care of a widow, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. You know, it is my duty as a father to protect from need and from want. I should be the first and the foremost line of defense, making sure that my family is fed, clothed, and properly housed. That's my job. I can, of course, amp that way out, and many do. At the same time, it is my job to make sure that that happens. And he says, you notice Paul gets pretty strong about it. He says, worse than an unbeliever if I don't take care of those, if I have the ability, of course. Okay, second in protection, protect from sin. Do I give, and I touched on this briefly, but do I give and require accountability? Do I say where I am, where I have been, what I have been doing? Do I require the same from my children once they're able to be out on their own? Protection, and that goes into the devices that we allow into our homes and how they function in that. You know, and anyway, I was getting to that briefly here, but one of the problems we have as a church is we think we set up these things to protect those within the church, and then fathers sit back on their hands and this is taken care of. No, sir, folks. You as a dad, first and foremost, should be protecting your home from whatever it is. Don't wait on some committee or anything to take care of that. Okay, protection from wrong choices. You know, children just don't necessarily like this one. And I get that. But children, being children, do not always know the results of their actions. Do we instruct and do we correct? Makes me think of years ago, as one of my uncles said this about a car accident. A dad, I think he was a foolish dad, had gone out, bought his son a brand new sports car of some kind. And the son, about the second time he was driving this thing, he goes out and wants to see how fast it can go, right? Which, I can associate with that somewhat. It's somewhat normal in a son. Hopefully, some control it better than he did. Anyway, he went out there, got this thing going as fast as he could, ran off the road, and totally mushed it. Was just fortunate he got out with his life. So the police and all the others showed up, of course, and were taking care of this accident. And the dad showed up on the scene, and he started looking sadly at the poor investment he made in the, I don't know, probably on the son and the car front, even if he didn't realize it. And he made the comment, he said, too much horsepower. And the policeman that was standing there said, no. He said, I've got the same engine in my car. He said, just not enough horse sense. You know, parents, you got to teach your children sense. They ain't born with it, most of them. There's some that seem a little wiser than others, but most of them are just lacking in plain sense. And it's your job to teach it to them. I have to think of the theme verse of one of my classes. Ponder the path of thy feet, that all thy ways may be established. A child does not naturally ponder the path of his feet. It depends on mom and dad to do that, in the way they drive, in the clothes they wear, in a lot of things. It's your job to ponder that and to help them learn how to ponder. Okay, the last one on protection. Protection from entitlement. Teach your children they are not the center of the universe. You know, one of my one of the others that processes applications for Bible school was talking to me, and so he does the basic work, and I guess I get the tough job. But anyway, he said this to me it was late Friday night, I guess. He said, youth today, they just think they deserve to come. Don't feed me that. When I'm looking over your application, you have absolutely no right to be in Bible school, youth. You might have the privilege if we grant it to you, but you don't have the right. Don't fool yourself. And some are going to find that out. Protect your children from entitlement. You know, from little on up, when they're there yelling for their bottle, I'm all for feeding babies, and I'm not a mean parent by all, but I think you start pretty young. Those things are smart. Dr. Charles Ware, he said, we talk about them like they were little angels, but he said, you know why? He said, they aren't. He said, they're little devils. And maybe that's a bit strong, but they got the carnal spirit, and they know pretty on quick when mom and dad is wrapped around their little finger. And they'll take that just as far as you let them. So again, don't be mean, but don't let them grow up entitled. Life is and should be about others, and the sooner a child gets some indications of that, the better. Live it that way. Be sacrificial yourself and teach sacrificial living. Okay, moving on. The base of obedience. This one, pretty heavy for me. Think in dog training. Don't they have something called basic obedience training? Is that right, Peanut? I think so. I was thinking of reading about that. You know, a dog that doesn't know when to sit and when to heel and when to fetch is a useless dog in the hunting field, more or less. And so is a son or a daughter that doesn't know what no means, or that doesn't know what it means when you're told to go to bed. Can they accept direction? Can they go when it is time to go? Can they stay when it is time to stay? Can they understand without having everything explained to them? Without understanding everything. And our culture has totally messed this up. And I'm not promoting necessarily the way it was back in, let's say, the 40s, 30s. I know of a writer, he said that when he was growing up, if his dad said, do something, you did it. Because, well, you were going to get whooped if you didn't. And he said, if his dad would have started explaining something to us, he would have been like, what is going on here? Run for your life, because he's not acting weird, you know? And I'm not saying there's no room to explain. In fact, we're taught to teach and to explain in that way. But finally, if I can't tell my child to do something without a 5-minute explanation, they don't know what obedience is. Second, like unto it, expectation of obedience. You know, there should be an expectation of obedience. Now, again, I'm not talking harsh, cruel. I'm not even talking about dogs or horses. Please understand, I was using some stories. And I'm all for giving expression and positive encouragement, and I want to grow in that. But it shouldn't astonish us, and I don't really think our children should expect commendation when they follow a simple command. You know what? Does God ever say, Joe, you're doing a good job down there. Thanks for preaching today. You know, he might encourage me in various ways. But finally, it is simply up to me to obey most of the time. And if I don't know just how to dig down and do what needs done, and I'm worried about this for our churches, there should be an expectation of obedience. Okay, last on this one, consequences for disobedience. First of all, as a parent, I covered this somewhat in, I need to kindly but firmly expect obedience. And another thing I see parents do, and I think they're well-meaning, but it's destructive, is do not step between a child and the result of their choices. At least not too early. I'm not saying never. You know, a lack of correction when correction is required, or bailing them out of a predicament because we love them so much, and an effort to lessen their pain, will only encourage more foolishness. And oh, how much easier it is to do this when you have a 5-year-old that has made a dumb mistake than when then you've got a 20, 30-year-old that's sitting in prison because he didn't learn it. Teach your 5-year-old that their actions have results. If you touch a hot stove, you get burned. And I'm not suggesting you touch them, deliberately touch a frying hot stove. But it seems to me every child needs to touch the stove someplace. Because you know what? And I'm not talking about a physical stove necessarily. If a child doesn't learn this early on, do you think they're going to believe you when they're 18, 19 and facing some major things? That the stove is hot? If you've always saved them from themselves? Absolutely not. But if they've learned, if they have a history that when dad says the stove is hot, boy, is it ever hot, then they get it. In the important things of life. Okay, the last point of this list. The home should be a base of self-discipline. I think, okay, folks, I'm talking about the home, and so I'm promoting good homekeeping. I want you to understand, if you grew up in a horrible home, there is God's forgiveness, there's God's help, and I believe he can catch you right up to somebody that's been in a good home. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying if you really want to give your child a start, this is how to do it. So on the base of self-discipline, I am almost, if it wouldn't be that God has said all things are possible with me, I would almost tell you that a child that grows up undisciplined will never become disciplined. That's how strong I feel about it. But I accept the scripture that God can do it, even though it looks almost impossible. Train up a child in the in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. I don't think this is talking about spiritually necessarily. Hopefully it trends that direction as well. But he's talking about, I think, self-discipline. Train up a child, you should go. If you have a disciplined child, you can have a somewhat disciplined adult. But if you don't teach that to a young child, I'd almost say, like I said, outside of God, just forget it. Proverbs 25, verse 28. He that hath no rule over his own spirit or can't control himself is like a city that is broken down and without walls. You know, in the Old Testament, those walls were put around a city to protect it so that not just every bandit could come into town and take everything. And a person, a young man, a young lady that hasn't learned self-discipline is just like a city without walls. There's no perimeters, there's no boundaries, there's nothing to stop them, and everything happens. You know, Aristotle, a Greek philosopher many years ago, said this. He said, "Give me a child until he is seven, and I will show you the man." Maybe that's a bit strong. But if you haven't laid a strong foundation for self-discipline before a child is 7, 8 years old, you've got some serious work in front of you the next couple years. Let's say it that way. Self-discipline. First of all, you better have it yourself. That's where schedule and all that comes in. You know, I've told many of the young men, I don't think schedule makes a Christian, but I think a Christian makes a schedule. That's how, for like personal devotions and that kind of thing, it just doesn't happen otherwise. Here's another thing I told my class in talking to late teens, early 20s. I really have found this true. But I would say early to mid-teens, you are a result of your home, of your parents, more or less, your church, your circumstance, your culture. But what you are from here on, from your mid-teens, late teens on, is a result of your choices. And so parents, when I look at a 16-year-old that's got major issues in their life, there's a problem with a parent, whether that parent's me or somebody else. You know, if a child is not taught self-discipline, is not taught to appreciate and accept delayed gratification, they will have endless problems. Be serious about this. Waiting, even for the needful and good, is a necessary part of growing up. A child that cannot wait patiently for lunchtime or for something else, I'm talking within reason, of course, if it's delayed, be charitable. But a child that cannot wait within reason, patiently for a meal, whatever, will become a youth that cannot wait on dad and mom's timing in much greater things. And another thing I think we really need to be teaching in our homes is relate to the people with you. And this was really brought home actually by youth. We were talking about how many youth activities there should be and all that. And you know, one of them pipes up and says, you know, now today, years ago, you had to go to the activity to be with other people. But he said, now you can be at home and be with other people through your phone. I don't think that ought to be. I mean, there's one thing if it's business. But really, if you're at home with your family, make it your family time. Lay those things aside. Focus on each other. Makes me think of the Matt Durstein some years ago was talking to a young man. And he asked him, so what do you do when you just want to have fun? Oh, he says, I get together with some other fellows and we go to town or we do this and that. And Matt was like, seriously? He said, well, why don't you play Scrabble with your mom? Oh, he said, it's not fun. Fun. Talking to a dad, a brokenhearted dad, just here a little bit ago. I'm not sure who to blame for all this. I'm not trying to blame youth necessarily. His broken-hearted dad said, I so wish I would have made more enjoyable family time. So dads, take it, put it back on us. But do you know what it is just to have a good time as a family, or does it require activity out there, activity over here? And if your family's too small to play Scrabble or whatever, invite one other family over. I'm all for family units relating to each other. But the family is still the base, the structure. I'm not anti-school, anti-church functions. But when and if we begin relying on those, and we need these, and we're entitled to these so that we can have a good time, we begin a process of undermining the home that we will live to regret. And I would even encourage you, make your family worship time something you enjoy. And I think you know this, but I'm going to talk briefly on it. I am absolutely not against it. If somebody's, well, Will was in Mexico or something, or if there's a pandemic, I'm glad for some of the tools we have that we can involve them in a church service per se. At the same time, you know that's all artificial. And I've heard a lot about this from youth, and Harry Argo was up there. You know, we get the idea that when we have these devices and we watch this, we're somehow connected, but it's fake. If you're using it as a tool to further discussion, listen to a message. Yes, if there's you can't come to church, it might be fine to listen to or watch a message. At the same time, you need to discuss it with the people with you. If it's just a thing of connecting through the device, you haven't connected at all. We need to connect with each other. Forget all these superficial, artificial imitations and connect for real. Harry Argo had a very interesting thought. He said what we need in our church is the Amish tape recorder. Do any of you know what that is? Amish tape recorder. That's the first time I'd heard of it. I was trying to figure out how this would work. He said, in Amish services, they have three or four older ladies that usually sit in the back that record everything, whether it be mentally or upon paper, and they can tell everybody everything about it. That's an Amish tape recorder. But he said what one church actually started doing, I think it was somewhat at his encouragement, is they actually get, if a family can't be there because of sickness or something else, they actually assign three young men to take notes of the message that day, and then they go preach the message to the people that couldn't be there. And he said it does a lot of good because they actually learn how to preach in the process. And he said if they ever get ordained, they already have 50 messages stored up. So you take that how you want to, but it's interesting food for thought. Okay, moving on. I'll try to wrap this up. A school, a church, a community, a nation is no stronger than the homes that compose it. No school and no amount of education can compensate for a lack of home teaching. No church and no accumulation of church guidelines. I'm not trying to slam some, but I'm talking about an accumulation of church guidelines can correct course when homes are not requiring obedience and respect. One last illustration here. This brings me to the Lancaster Conference. In late 50s, early 60s, Lancaster Conference was a bit different than a lot of general conference in that they had, for the most part, a very united and concerned leadership. And they took a hard line on television, yet I'm told that they had a standard on television, they preached against television, and yet 65% of the membership had television in either the basement or the attic, and did what they want to. You know, it's a joke making church rules when you've got a group like that, right? If it don't start in the home, it don't matter what we preach, teach, philosophize about. It's just a bunch of stupidity to the people listening, really. Maybe this is too strong for you, and if it needs watered down, that's fine. But I wondered, shouldn't the task of all outside the home organizations and institutions be to support and enable the home? If they do more or less than this, aren't they becoming a liability? You know, thinking of our school, I'm so glad we have a school. Don't get me wrong for one minute. But as the school board meets, as the teachers start their day, shouldn't they be asking, shouldn't they be praying, how can we best teach and support the homes represented in this school? As a church, shouldn't we continually be asking, how can we strengthen, how can we empower the homes within the church to be more what God wants to be? And that saying, I understand sometimes we have misfit problems. We're not sure where to go, and I'm saying there's a lot of growth needed on every side. It takes give and take, and I'm not saying that we let one family run the school or the church. That's not what I'm saying at all. At the same time, do we support respect? Let's say a family does draw a line differently than someone else. Do we help the children appreciate that, or do they sort of, oh, yeah, I don't know, your dad one of them with a weak conscience, or what's wrong with him, but What convictions do you have on and for the home? How are you applying those convictions? Remember, it's the people that make the home, and it's the home that makes the church and the school, the community and the nation. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. Let's kneel for prayer.